This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown. It's about 10 after 1. We're getting a slightly later start than sometimes because of the news, the May Day Latino news, which we'll be repeating various times during the day here on KVMR. But for the next 50 minutes, I'm going to be talking with one of the best writers about California and then a local citizen who has a very interesting book idea. The best writer on California, or one in my opinion, is Peter Schrag, who has been an editorial page editor on the Sacramento Bee for many years and is now a columnist and has also written a number of very interesting books about the current state of California polity. About 8 years ago, he came out with Paradise Lost, which was revised and issued as a paperback in 2002, and now he's just published through the University of California Press, California, America's High Stakes Experiment. And I'd like to catch up with him a bit and find out what he thinks of the current state of California. Welcome to Booktown, Peter Schrag.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I want to say very quickly that when I began to read the introduction to your latest book, California, I thought this might just be an update of Paradise Lost, and I had found Paradise Lost so fascinating that I thought just being brought up to date might be quite sufficient. But I notice your point of view has shifted, I would say, fairly substantially in those 8 years. So I'd like to maybe go over the basic state of California as you see it, how you saw things. California was in the what you call the paradise years of the immediate post-war years, and how that all changed with Proposition 13.
Well, it changed a lot. I don't know if it was just Proposition 13 that caused it. I mean, Proposition 13 was as much a consequence of, I think, a change of mood and a change of conditions in California as it was the cause. I mean, Prop 13 didn't come out of the blue. It certainly has had a huge impact in California, and you know, we can talk the whole hour about that. But I think so many other things have happened, both before and since. I mean, you're right, this is a different book from Paradise Lost, and it's not just an update. And I don't know how much I've changed my, what many people think is kind of a pessimistic outlook, but I certainly have, I think, broadened it and found, I mean, it's like so many things, the more we watch them, the less sure we get about the certainties we once had. It's certainly a different book, and a friend of mine said she was just about to buy it, and I said, well, good, but don't take it to the beach because it's not, you know, it's not that cheerful.
Well, I found it considerably more cheerful than Paradise Lost, but I think we should get to that a little later.
Okay.
I get your main argument in both books was that California at one point, the voters and the population were roughly the same, and
right,
the people were willing to pay a lot of money for services which they could see coming to their benefit.
Right.
But that recently, especially with immigration, there are more and more members of the population who don't vote, and the people who do vote, who tend to be whiter and older, are increasingly less willing to pay for schools, highways, and things like that where they don't see a particular benefit.
I think that's true. I mean, there's no way of proving that, and there are certainly a lot of people who will say that at the local level, for example, particularly in the last few years, voters have been fairly supportive, for example, of school bonds, school construction, even in communities like Los Angeles, where a large proportion of the, where there is a big gap between the voters and the people who are the prime beneficiaries of those services. So it's not a totally black or white thing, but I think on the whole it's still true, and I think there's some evidence. And of course, the further you get away, the more abstract, I suppose, the higher the level at which those decisions are made. So at the state level, I think it probably applies more than it does at the local level. But I think it's certainly true that the gap between the voters, two-thirds of whom in California are still, as you said, white, Anglo, older, somewhat more affluent, and the people who are most dependent on the services, who are younger, browner, less affluent, and tend to vote less, is certainly great. And I think even through sort of through our national history, there's some evidence that there's a kind of inverse relationship, for example, between immigration and progressive social policy.
Now, when I lived on the in the East and the Midwest before I moved to California when I was 23, I would have always thought of California as being one of the states with one of the largest Latino populations. This would have been back in the 50s and 60s as I was growing up. But you point out in this book that L.A. until recent decades was probably the whitest big city in the country.
That's correct. And California as a whole until 1960 or 65 was also still overwhelmingly white Anglo. I mean, my favorite factoid, which I've quoted again and again, is that in the 1960 census, the language most frequently spoken by foreign-born residents of California was English, because there were more Canadian and British natives in California than there were Latinos. Obviously, that's changed dramatically in the last 40, 45 years. But it was true then, and I think Californians at that point hardly noticed Latinos. Clearly, there was certainly a fairly significant black population, much of which came to the state during the war to work in shipyards and in other industries. But until the 70s or the late 60s, the Latino population was still it was here, but it wasn't very visible.
So when I lived in Chicago and Boston, and I thought California was exotic because it had Chinese and some Mexicans and jazz, black jazz musicians, I was probably completely wrong. And in the cities I was in with their Polish and Irish and Italian immigrants were probably more varied.
Well, and there was certainly a lot of black jazz musicians in Chicago as well. But at least I thought so. But I think it was true. I mean, California, even before the war, and you know, and through various means, I think promoted itself as a somewhat exotic place, and I think that goes back way back to the, you know, to the writings of Helen Hunt Jackson and the Ramona stories and all that, you know, with the sort of the colorful sort of Mexican fiestas and all that stuff that was sort of sprinkled in there. And and then, of course, there was the Chinese, the sort of exotic Chinese thing, though, as you know, until the 1940s, we treated the Chinese terribly. But I think all of those things became and have now recently become very much part of the landscape. It isn't simply that statistically we're now a majority-minority state, but that I think most Californians now, in most parts of California, certainly in the big urban areas, hardly notice that anymore. And I think we're much less aware of, sort of daily aware of the browning of the state. And I don't mean that just by Mexicans, but by I sat and watched on the platform, watched a University of California at Berkeley political science commencement a couple of years ago, and of the 400 students who walked across the platform, it was hard for me to tell what they were, whether they were from Asian or whether they were mixed this or whether they were Latinos or they were from the Middle East. It was amazing.
And back in those days, I guess especially after World War II, during the war and afterwards, there were many guest workers, braceros, who came and went.
Right.
And I guess the two big, maybe if you had to identify the two big changes in California from those earlier days, Prop 13 with its cap on the property taxes might be one of them, and the other might be the change in American immigration laws.
I think that's correct. I think those things are both exceedingly important. And of course, then the other thing is the huge change in the economy. California's economy in the 50s was still very much dependent on, among other things, manufacturing, aircraft manufacturing, auto manufacturing, steel, all of that stuff that, you know, which grew great here before and during the war. And all of that, of course, began to either move out or simply the plants closed up. So our economy became much more a high-tech economy, and of course we still have agriculture
and
entertainment.
Yeah. And what was the big change in immigration law that occurred actually only 20 years ago, and how did that?
Well, there were two big changes. One was in 1965 when we repealed the national origins quotas that had essentially set quotas for immigrants. First of all, very tight quotas, but based basically on the formula on how many of their ethnic or regional or national forebears were here. So if you were Chinese, you're pretty much excluded, and if you were a Brit, you're probably in pretty good shape. But the quotas themselves were very small. That went back to 1924. In 1965, that was repealed. And then, of course, in 1986, which is what you're referring to, we had IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which granted amnesty to a large number of illegal residents and supposedly created employer sanctions to reduce illegal immigration and so on. It didn't work out quite the way it was planned. And the result was that there was, as there was after 65, a fairly large surge of new immigration, particularly both legal, obviously legal immigration in the sense that a lot of illegal people were legalized, and also a new wave of illegal immigration as the newly legalized immigrants sent for their families and so on.
But also people who had come here illegally were much less inclined to go back to Mexico or Central America.
Well, that's been the result of the further tightening of the border, border enforcement in the last 10, 15 years. That was since, well, it began with IRCA, but particularly since as we've built more fences, more walls, and hired more Border Patrol agents, it became more risky and more expensive for an illegal to come north, so that once they were here, they were and have been less likely to go back.
So it has the exact opposite result.
Yes.
Of yes. What was intended.
Yes, it has. So the number of illegal residents in this country has gone up very sharply in the last 10, 15 years, and particularly sharply in the last few years. And it's a complicated dynamic, because all kinds of things happen. And I think if you're a conservative on this issue, you're probably right in part, you would say that even when there's talk of some form of legalization or of regularization or, you know, all the things that are part of the conversation now and have been again since George Bush was elected in 2000, a new there's more incentive again for people to come here illegally in the hope that they will get in under the umbrella of whatever amnesty or quasi-amnesty is declared.
Now, you mentioned also that in spite of these facts, we still have a smaller percentage of immigrants in the general population than we did 100 years ago.
Yes, that's true.
And that the number of immigrants of illegal or new immigrants as a proportion of the population is going to go down in the next few years, and that fewer and fewer of them stay in California.
That's correct. All of those things are correct.
So why is everyone so worried?
Well, for one reason, partly the worry is now, or the I don't know if it's the worry or it's backlash or it's anxiety, I suppose, is that obviously the worry is now no longer just in California, and all the things that we went through back in 94 during the recession when we passed Prop 187, the initiative that sought to deny schooling and other services to illegal immigrants, all of those things are now beginning to happen elsewhere in the country. So that while California is no longer the overwhelming destination of immigrants, legal and illegal, the impact is now being felt in the Southeast, in the Midwest, where there are now communities where, with large, and in the Northeast for that matter, where there are now communities with rapidly growing numbers of particularly Latinos, many of them from Mexico. And so it's become a national phenomenon. And I think it's also tied in with a lot of other things that are sort of inchoate. One of them is just the anxiety, the general economic insecurity of a lot of Americans who are feeling pressure not only from immigrants or illegal immigrants, but clearly pressure from competition overseas. So all of this, and I get emails from people, for example, construction workers, who say, I have nothing against immigrants, even illegal immigrants, but my employers in the construction industry are basically lowering my wages because they can hire and exploit these people who are here illegally.
There's many other topics I'd like to go on in this book, but while we're on this, since this is the day of nationwide demonstrations and the motto "Nos somos todos ilegales" has been going around, we are all illegals in one sense or another. Do you see a easy or even a difficult solution to this problem?
that's certainly not an easy one. I think you can look at it in all kinds of ways. You look at it as an immediate policy question, and I think that the bill that's been kicking around the Senate, which is basically the McCain-Kennedy proposal, seems to me, which kind of comprises some form of legalization, whatever you want to call it, with an attempt at maybe stronger employer sanctions. I think one of the things we probably have to do is create some kind of ID system to reduce, to make it easier to identify illegal workers. But I think that's all just short-term stuff. And as I say, it has so many consequences. And I think a lot of the short-term stuff I would see as being a plus only because it will, to some extent, maybe assuage political stresses in our society. I mean, one of the things I worry about is, and that's of course the basic question of the book, is to what extent will the voters be willing to support generous public services for people they perceive to be different from themselves, even though those people are going to be a mainstay of our economy in the coming years. So you really do want educated workers. But I think in the long run, I'm beginning to ask the question, and I think it's a question that really has to be asked, is the border really a line or has it become a region? And do we have to recognize that there are so many things that join us now to, particularly to Mexico, and so many common issues that we eventually have to approach this whole thing in a much broader way. And I'm not suggesting that we stop border enforcement. I'm simply saying that there are so many things that link us, and that link families, and that link us economically, and movement of goods and capital, and all the rest of it, that I'm not sure that this sort of narrow immigration debate by itself has a broad enough focus.
You say in the book that essentially it's not a question of whether the United States and Mexico will integrate, it's a question of how they will integrate.
That's right.
And you point out that the European Union, when what were at that point the two poorest countries in Western Europe, Spain and Portugal, wanted to join the EU, decided the only way it could really accommodate this was by giving massive aid to those countries to bring up their economies. And you suggested maybe that's what we should be doing with Mexico.
Well, I think so. I think the big hitch is the political corruption in Mexico. And I think that's the kind of still the closed nature of the Mexican economy, which still isn't really open for opportunity the way ours is. So I think somehow, and I think Mexico is slowly moving in that direction. I think Vicente Fox has tried to push in that direction, but clearly it's still a very long road. But yes, I think that's right. And then somebody else has suggested, which I think is also true, that in the long run, North America, meaning Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, maybe what has to be created in the long run is some kind of North American community in which all of these common problems, environmental, immigration, crime, drugs, you name it, the whole schmear has to be commonly managed and enforced, because the national, the sort of national institutions, those within just one border, simply aren't going to work. And it's certainly, the economy has already kind of become so multinational that, and I'm not just talking about the U.S. and Mexico or Canada, but certainly with Asia and so on, that other forms of regulation and control have to be put in place.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm talking with Peter Schrag, author of, most recently, California, America's High Stakes Experiment, just published by University of California Press. Before we go on to other questions, I just one last question about the immigration issue. This is one of the few issues on which I think President Bush has got it roughly correct. I think maybe McCain and Kennedy are even closer to that. But he's being fought by most, or resisted by most of his own party. This is partly because he has lost a lot of power, but I think he probably has never tried to implement the good ideas he had on immigration because he knew there'd be so much resistance in the party.
I think that's partly true, though. I think the party itself, I think it's not just Bush versus his own party. I think that the Republican Party itself is to some extent split internally because of the... obviously, they're under a lot of pressure from the business community, which is interested in Mexican labor particularly, and many of whom I think feel that their own operations would be severely affected, which is, of course, the point of these demonstrations today, is to show that is that the country can't operate without immigrant labor. And I think to some extent that feeling is reflected within the Republican Party. But you're right, it is certainly an issue between certainly the conservatives in the party and the president.
To go on to other issues you raise in the book, in Paradise Lost, you gave a pretty detailed explanation of the rise of initiatives and direct democracy in California, and you were very critical of it, saying essentially it showed distrust of government, distrust of people's politicians and their representatives. Now that process has gone even farther. We've had not only initiatives and referendums, but a recall.
Right.
But you don't sound quite as worried in this book as you did in the previous one. Maybe that's because you've gotten inured to it, or what?
Well, that may be the right answer. I'm still worried about it. I still, but you know, it. You can only rail about something so long, and then you get so tired of the sound of your own voice. I'm still very dubious about it. I'm dubious about it because I think more and more it's become a plaything of people with money and with power, and is not really a people's people's, meaning average people's device anymore for doing the things that it was advertised to do when it was put in place, you know, almost 100 years ago. But it is I think a problematic, and it's a real wild card in our governance system at this point. And I think it's still part of this, what I think is this vicious cycle where there's some problem exists, the legislature can't or doesn't address it for whatever reason, partly because it's lost power through previous initiatives. And so we have another ballot measure to remedy that, which further reduces the legislature's discretion, and the next problem comes along and the same thing happens again. And that certainly has happened again and again over the last 20 years, 20, 30 years almost. And I think that's really a problem. And of course, the more we depend on initiatives, and the more the legislature or state government as a whole, the formal state government, becomes either suspect or ineffective, and it's a combination of both, the less the voters pay attention to. You know, everybody said the recall brought out this great new outpouring of political energy and interest in government and so on, but it really only lasted about 6 months.
And there's two other points which I believe you made in Paradise Lost, but came out much more sharply in your newer book, maybe because there wasn't as much other detail. And one is that California is the only state with an initiative process where the legislature cannot modify the initiatives that have been passed, and that it's the only one that has such a supermajority for budgets and taxes.
That's correct. It's one of the two or three that requires the two-thirds supermajority for budgets and taxes, and it's you're right. It's the only one where statutory initiatives can't be modified or repealed under certain conditions or after a certain period of time by the legislature. Here, unless the initiative provides for its own amendment by the legislature, which most don't, the only way you can change is by another vote of the people. And that makes the whole thing much more inflexible than it is in other states.
Because there have been attempts to lower the supermajority, and it's, I believe, succeeded in one case, but in no others.
Well, it succeeded in the case of local school bonds.
Right.
Where we went from two-thirds to 55%. But in all of the, you're right, in all other cases, it's not succeeded.
And it doesn't look very likely right now that the California voters would want to give up either the sort of inviolability of the initiative process or the supermajorities.
No, I think that's correct. And there was an attempt, as you said, I think that was in 2002, but it might have been, I think it was 2002 or 2004, I can't recall now, to lower those things to 55% as well, the two-thirds majority for taxes and budgets. And it was soundly defeated. It might have had a better chance, but it applied only to the budget and not to increasing taxes, but probably would have failed anyway.
Another thing that you gave a lot of emphasis to, more in Paradise Lost than in the new book, was the fiscalization of the sales tax, a property tax rather, and the way that our system of taxing has sort of reversed itself, that now the state government has taken over a lot of the property tax revenues, and to make up for that, they've given more and more of the sales tax to the counties and cities, but that means that there's much less local control over how tax money is spent.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right. That's correct. So, you know, that's been, I didn't emphasize it as much in this new book because I felt it had been discussed at considerable length in the other book, and I mean, you don't want to write the same book over again. And I think I alluded to it in the new book, but I didn't make as much of it. But you're right. The state government has certainly become more powerful but also more ineffective at the same time, which is sort of interesting. I mean, certainly the state government has control over a lot of the taxes. The local government don't control their own revenues really very much, so they have to sort of dependent on the state. And that, of course, also creates sort of divided accountability about, you know, when things go wrong. Is it because the state didn't provide enough money, or is it because the locals blew it? So, and all of those things, yes, you're right. I talked about it much more in Paradise Lost. But, you know, you don't want to tell the same story again.
Right. And at that time, when I talked to you two and a half years ago, to me, the solution seemed to be for somebody to come up with a really clear plan of just reversing that process and giving the state more control over sales taxes and the counties more control over the property taxes. And you thought there was no chance of that happening.
I don't think so. I think as soon as there's anything that sounds like you're tinkering with Prop 13, you're in trouble. And I think that's still true. And there may still be a chance for some kind of a split roll where commercial property is taxed on a different basis or a different rate or is assessed in different ways from residential property. And that might still, I mean, you know, there continues to be talk about that. But anything that where somebody can say you're tinkering with Prop 13 and this is the beginning of a slippery slope, I think it's all over.
We're running short on time, and I've only gotten to a number of the newer issues in the new book. You spend a lot of time talking about the ultimate example of direct hyper-democracy, and that was the recall of Gray Davis and Arnold Schwarzenegger's sudden appearance as governor. And it looked for a while as if he might consolidate much more power in the governor's hands and really emasculate the legislature, but that didn't happen.
No.
How come?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, how come?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. First, I think he didn't go about it very well. I think the voters tend to be innately conservative. I don't mean conservative in the sense of right wing, but conservative in the sense of cautious. I think they were nervous. And Governor Wilson tried the same thing, or tried one of those same things some years ago, and he lost on that too, which was essentially to expand the power of the governor on budgets. If money ran short, then he could essentially reduce spending as he wished. I'm oversimplifying all this now. But I think the voters aren't comfortable with that. I don't think they want to give the governor, even though they don't trust the legislature, they trust the legislature less than the governor. I think they're worried about making those kinds of structural changes. And I think one of the questions I raised in this book is the question of whether, despite all the complaints from voters that Sacramento is not solving the problems and that they're elected to solve the problems and they should do more and et cetera, et cetera, I'm not sure that deep down the voters really want that. I'm not sure that the voters aren't, despite the complaints and legitimate complaints about everything from inadequate schools to roads that are full of holes and all the rest of it, whether in the larger sense we really want government to work that well, because I think at the moment we're unsure of where we want to go, and again, in light of these new demographics, this new population, sure, we'd all like to get to work faster, we'd like to get rid of traffic jams, but I'm not sure that the willingness to make government work really well is all that great.
You talk in the book about California as being America's high-stakes experiment and the place where multiculturalism and direct democracy are being carried out more than any place else in the country and perhaps in the world. And you also say that it, as time goes on, the voter, the population and the voters will come more and more to be congruent, and that there will be fewer new immigrants. Do you see that as the voting population and the general population get closer, there might be more response to our, yes, our needs?
Yes, I think so. And there'll be less of a dichotomy and less and less pressure for ballot measures, because if once the voting, I mean, in a way, the legislature is already reflects, because of the way we redistrict and a lot of other things, the legislature is closer to the general population than the voters are close to the general population, which means the legislature tends to be more liberal. It's more heavily influenced by the new population, particularly by Latinos. As the general voting population catches up with that, the split between both voters and the population, and between the legislature and the voters, will decline. And I think we'll be less prone to recalls, ballot initiatives, and so on.
Okay, thanks so much, Peter Schrage. This book, California, America's High States Experiment, which has just been published by University of California Press, I think even more fascinating than the last one. And I hope to check in with you when you take your next take on California.
Well, thank you, and your questions have been terrific.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and in the next 10 minutes, I'm going to talk with a prominent local resident about a very interesting idea. There's a bit of background for this in that I had somewhat the same idea 10 years ago, although not quite the same. This person and I talked about it way back then, when we weren't quite the same, but I dropped mine. That was when the Nevada County Library was in such a bad shape before Measure C passed, the sales tax, which has really turned it around. I thought that individual citizens should pool the books they had that were not represented in the library and create a sort of private library that individuals could go and use, pretty much the same as the public library, but would have many things that the public library couldn't afford. After Measure C, I pretty much dropped it, but Alan Haley, who's with me now, has not dropped it, and he's got an even more ambitious idea than I did. What's your idea, Alan?
Well, there's, as you know, a lot of people with large private libraries, I think, in this area, stretching from Sacramento to Lake Tahoe, and particularly people who have specialized in making collections in particular areas. And on their death, about all they can do is hand that over to their executors to either go to some other big library collection or to be sold and scattered and dispersed among all the various used book dealers. My idea is to create a private library here for the foothills that to which those collections can be donated, and make it on the model of the Athenaeum in Boston that was started in the 18th century by the founding patriots of Boston there, and that has remained a private library to this day, with wonderful old historical collections and unique books that can't be found in many other libraries in New England. And it's always maintained itself by private subscription. I think people need to pay a small fee in order to demonstrate their appreciation and support for things. I think that things that are offered truly for free start going downhill after a while. And so there would be a subscription fee to maintain it, but the idea would be to bring as many books as we can in private collections together and get the strength of that in one place and provide a place for people to deal with their collections of books over the years.
And it turns out that you not only have been thinking about this, but you've actually begun to act.
Yes. I've located some premises here in Nevada City that I think will serve it very well. And then the next step now is to organize a board and take out nonprofit papers. So that's what I'd like to do as the next step. I've got a core collection of books that we can start off with, and we've got spaces for it and shelving built and so on.
Now, this core collection that I've seen is a large library of science and mathematics. And are the premises the place where those are now housed?
Yes, that's, you just saw one of three rooms with the science and mathematics in it. There's another room with history, English, religion, and philosophy, and another one with more general foreign language, literature, and social, cultural history.
And what would it cost to maintain this? Just paying the rent for something like this could be pretty expensive. In the long run, would it be good to have an actual owned building?
In the long run, yes. I think the Board of Trustees could guide that through. Rental is probably cheaper than ownership to start with, unless there was, a property donated. If they had to go out and acquire a property from scratch and raise the money to do that, I think it would be more expensive than just the rental. The rental for the three rooms together would run around $2,200 a month.
So you have to have a fairly good number of people who would, what do you imagine people would pay in?
Well, I'd like to keep it on the order of around $25 or $30 a month, a dollar a day kind of thing. And so if we had, that would be 100 people at $25 would provide us with $2,500 a month. And we could go upward from there to provide salaries for a librarian. I think most of it would be on, it would be a minimal overhead other than the librarian and the space itself.
And you have other people who are interested?
I have other people that have expressed an interest in their, donating their collections.
What sort of collections are these?
Well,
you don't have to name names.
Right. There's one very extensive one in California history, California historical materials. And there's another one that goes with, is a complement to the science library that I've already accumulated. And some other specialties, like one person said they have an extensive collection of biographies. So I think it reflects people's, eclecticism and taste. And I'm sure as the word gets out, there will be all kinds of discoveries that we didn't know about.
Now, say for the California history books, this is sort of scattering things. We already have the Searles Library and the Foley Library.
Yes, but if you've been in there, the library, the Foley Library in particular, I'm familiar with. It's got a lot of the historical records, like the assessor's records and tax records and so on. And the Searles Library is so small that only one person can be in there at one time. So those collections are fairly limited in access, and I think we could improve on that.
So actually the Searles Library could possibly be incorporated in this at some point?
Wow, that's a grand plan, and that would require, I think, a major facility that we would look forward to.
And right now it's definitely a part of our tradition to have that little building right across from the courthouse.
Definitely, definitely. And I don't know where we'd be without its librarian, too, Ed Tyson.
So are you now ready for average Joe Blow on the street to get in touch with you and say, I'd like to help?
I think so, and I'm very ready to receive expressions of interest from people who'd like to be on the board of directors to get at some guiding principles and how we would set things up and get a budget going. And as I say, get the nonprofit papers on file so that then we can accept contributions.
Now, I am guessing from what I saw of the books in your science and my guess was that you had 3,000 to 5,000 books in that room, maybe?
I think that's about right.
And so you might already have 15,000 books.
I think so.
And I could see this easily becoming 30,000 books all of a sudden. That's going to take a lot of work.
It is, but there'll be, in some cases, I'm sure there'll be duplication. And so we'll generate, not only through the duplication, we could generate some proceeds from book sales and so on. We could have second copies of books that are, you know, checked out frequently. And so I think you just have to manage it and see in what areas the group is the strongest, and the board would have to decide when we branch out and take another new collection and what kind of space requirements it would have and so on.
So if people are interested in this, how do they get in touch with you?
The easiest way is to drop me a card or note at P.O. Box 1710, Nevada City.
Okay, and that's Alan Haley.
A-L-L-A-N-H-A-L-E-Y. And otherwise, I'm in the phone book, too, at 505 Coyote Street, 265-6357. But it's hard to, that's my law business, and it's hard to get through sometimes because it's very busy.
And the Athenaeum in Boston is more than just a library.
Yes, it is. It's first of all, it's a gathering place for and a great kids section where they have all kinds of programs for kids. And then it's an historic building and designed with the shells and the atoms. We can't quite aspire to that yet, but maybe long term.
But eventually you might want to move in that direction?
Yes. Well, you know, making any building and doing it right is always my first criterion. If you're going to have a place where people can access books, it should be well lit. And the shelves should be compact and accessible and make it a joy to come to and open a book and sit down and want to read.
So you've got to have a lot of chairs, too.
Yes, you'd need that, too. I think for the start here, though, what we'd do is this would be a place where you would come to pick up a book and take it away as opposed to a place to come and browse and read. There'd be limited capability to handle that sort of thing at first.
Because it probably couldn't be open. You couldn't afford to have it open
all the time.
All the time, right.
So it'll have to be, you know, it'll be a private collection, and then the more we can get it up on the internet where people can find out from their own computer just what it has and what would be useful, they could make a list and come there and, you know, look at the books or get the books they want.
Is there an internet way of reaching you now, or you prefer phone? Or
No, internet also. I have email at ashaley, A-S-H-A-L-E-Y, at nccn.net.
Okay, and the phone number and snail mail again?
Snail mail, P.O. Box 1710, Nevada City, 95959, and telephone 530-265-6357.
Okay. Thanks very much, Alan Haley. It's an exciting idea, and it's something I never thought would get this far.
Okay, great.
This has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. Before we make way for May Day News and Jimmy Icardi's Rock and Roll Party, a couple of events coming up. The Sierra Writers will celebrate the winners of its 6th annual Teen Short Story Contest Wednesday, May 10th at 7 p.m. at the Madeline Helling Library in Nevada City, with an evening dedicated to their writing. The field of 119 entries has been narrowed to 12 finalists. I have a list of them, and you can probably get it from going to sierrawriters.org. The winners of the Lee Roddy Award will be presented with scrolls and cash prizes. The first prize is $150, second is $125, and third is $100. And the contest is open to all teens aged 15 to 19 years old that either reside or attend school in Nevada County. Now, they're down to their finalists for this year, but you can enter next year, and if you want to go this year, it'll be Wednesday, May 10th, at 7 p.m. at the Madeline Helling Library. And the next day, on May 11th, from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at HQ, Headquarters for the Arts, 1719 25th Street in Sacramento, Poets and Writers is having their next literary roundtable. If you want more information about that, I think you can go to, well, Poets and Writers, I'd say they're way down in, I'm not going to give you any more information about that because I don't know if it's reliable. But it's Thursday, May 10th from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at HQ, Headquarters for the Arts, 1719 25th Street in Sacramento. We're going to come up with some May Day news, 5 minutes of that, and then Jimmy Icardi's Rock and Roll Party. This is KVMR FM, Nevada City.